heat is in proportion to the want of true knowledge. This is the heat.
Pakistan and Egypt, two countries working to improve their economies. We'll discuss the challenges and potential path forward. Hello, I'm Arend Naidoo, and this is a special edition of The Heat. As finance leaders meet in Washington, D.C. for the International Monetary Fund World Bank spring meetings, we're taking a closer look at the economic outlook for Pakistan and Egypt. Later, we'll hear from the Egyptian finance minister about efforts to tackle high inflation and how China's Belt and Road Initiative is helping to modernize its cities and infrastructure. But we begin with my conversation with Pakistan's Minister for Finance and Revenue, Mohammad Aurangzeb, on discussions with the IMF for a new multi-billion dollar loan agreement, relations with China, and much more.
Minister, thanks so much for joining us. You come to your job as the finance minister of Pakistan from the corporate world, banking to be more specific. You also come to the job at a crucial time for Pakistan. There are economic challenges, there are debt problems. But you want to implement a transition. You want to implement reforms to what is going on. I should also add that you're not accepting a salary for this job. What are your hopes? What do you hope to achieve?
Let me first say that we have entered this year on a much better note as compared to where we were this time last year. And this I can also recount as a practitioner when I was a banker in the country. So all macro variables have gone in the right direction, right? Whether it's our current account deficit, whether it's FX reserves, our primary surplus, currency stability. This week, we have initiated a discussion with the fund that we want a larger and a longer facility, really for two reasons. One is to ensure permanence of the macroeconomic stability. And the second thing is, and that's coming to your point, in terms of allowing us enough time to execute the reform agenda. And I've been saying that, and I will continue to say that, that the country has known the what and why for a very long time. So under Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, for the last 4 weeks, we have actually entered the execution phase. And it's around really three key areas, right? First is broadening the tax base. Our tax to GDP, as you know well, is a little below 10%, can't be sustainable. And the idea is to move it towards a 15% number. Similarly, our energy equation, power, petroleum, again, a lot of leakages. But although at the same time, we need to move it towards the private sector, reduce the subsidies, reduce the drag. Because if we don't do it, our industrial policy, our focus on exports is all going to be compromised. That's the second one. And the third thing is SOE reforms in general, because it's such a large drag on the exchequer and on our fiscal situation that we don't have enough to do in all other sectors unless we have that fiscal space. So really accelerating the privatization agenda. So from my perspective, it's a short-term, medium-term, long-term. The short-term stuff has already been initiated.
So as you say, the situation has changed for the better, relatively speaking, since last summer. Now you've approached the IMF for a new program to try and implement the economic reforms that you are talking about. What's been the response from the IMF? Are you confident? Do you feel optimistic?
So I've met the managing director, Christina, a couple of days back. Of course, we've met the senior management, including Jihad Azur. And I have to say that they have been very receptive. And there is a genuine desire on both ends to actually move with speed. So in the first instance, we are going to broadly agree on the prioritization. And the priorities, quite frankly, are not too different. That's why I continue to call it that it's the Pakistan program, which is helped, supported, assisted, and inshallah getting funded by IMF as we go forward as well. We expect the IMF mission to be in Islamabad by sort of middle of May. And then I think that's where we start getting into really granular level in terms of the contours of the program. And if all goes well, it's certainly our desire to have a staff level agreement by end June, early July. So that's the time frame.
Right. So you say the first phase is already underway. It's already being implemented. You are talking to consultants right now. So what are some of the specific things you'll be looking for in the next few months?
Yeah. In the first instance, what we are trying to do with respect to our tax authority, which is FBR, to first of all stem the leakages. When I say leakages, these are stuff where we need and can do more in terms of enforcement of the existing existing rules and regulations, etc., and just stem those leakages. But also there are lawsuits which are languishing with the tribunals, and you know, in conjunction with the Attorney General and the Law Minister, what we are requesting the tribunals is to decide. I'm not saying everything is going to be decided in favor of the tax authority, but at least some of that money can be released. So this is the short-term stuff. The medium-term is the point that you made around the consultants, and that is to bring in consultant to have end-to-end digitalization of the tax authority. Actually, tonight, I'm speaking to the shortlist of consultants, and what we are aiming for is to appoint that consultant before the month is out. And that consultant, the TORs are such that they will not only work on the design work, but they will also be embedded for the implementation. And why are we focusing on digitalization? And it's really three reasons. One, it'll help bring transparency. It will reduce the human intervention. In turn, it will, both of these points will increase our revenues. But the last thing that I want to mention is, because when we start talking about numbers, we at times forget about it, and that's the client experience, right? And if we get in the right place in terms of the client experience, that will help restore trust and confidence back into the tax authority, which will go a long way.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago the question on subsidies. There are some analysts who are urging you to cut subsidies on things like gas, petroleum. They also want you to reduce expenditure and balance the budget. How do you see it?
So I think it has to be a combination of both. So if we are going to reduce the fiscal deficit, not only revenues have to go up, but we also have to look at the expenditure side. And it's not only the operational expenditure. And you've already referred to that I think it's a good symbolic move by the cabinet that we said we are not going to draw out any salaries. But it's not going to make a dent. So what is going to help us is to think on the expenditure side, think a bit differently. And what I mean by that is, do we still, for example, need infrastructure in the country? Yes, we do. Does government have to do and foot the entire bill? The answer is no. So we have to move towards public-private partnerships. And there's one province in the country which has done a very good job with respect to infrastructure projects by bringing in the PPP discipline. And that's what we need to bring at the federal level and certainly in other provinces as well. So there are various ways that we bring that expenditure down. The subsidies that you refer to, those have to be brought down for two reasons. One, obviously, they are a large drag on the country's balance sheet. But even more importantly, there's sort of a shotgun approach. When you do these untargeted subsidies, I benefit the same way as someone else, and I should certainly not be benefiting. And it's really for the most vulnerable segments that you actually provide subsidies and provide targeted subsidies. And we do have a program called Benazir Income Support Program, which I do think we should actually increase the subsidy there, given the impact on the poverty level in the country. But at the same time, you know, we have to create space for many things. I mean, I just talked to you about sort of the reform agenda around the things that we need to get fixed. But if you think about it, there are many other things which we need to address if we have to take the country forward. Climate change. Pakistan is one of the most vulnerable countries, and the adaptation finance that we need. We'll certainly need a lot of external help, but we'll also need to create space internally. Then the second thing is it's not only digitalization in FBR, but it's really we have to think through digital Pakistan. And the last thing I want to mention is human capital, right? The resources that we need for health, education, children out of school, child stunting, huge issue. And think about it, this is the future of the country. And we need to create resources to address these issues. And I have to say the discussion that I had, when you talked about the discussions with the fund, and with Kristalina and her team, but the discussion that I've had with Mr. Ajay Banga, I tell you, is hugely refreshing, because the way he's now sort of taking the World Bank route forward is also very much focused on impact. And the three things that I've mentioned to you, whether it's climate change, whether it's human capital, whether it's digitalization, I think World Bank Group has always been a fantastic partner for Pakistan. But now their focus on this, which is truly aligned with our needs and priorities, I think World Bank Group overall is going to play a much bigger role as a partner, as a thought leader, but also as a funder.
Right. And on that shift to a digital economy, the World Bank has already approved, $78 million for the Digital Economy Enhancement Project. What can you tell us about that project and how it fits into your broader plans for the economy?
Yeah, I think in pieces and in verticals, actually Pakistan has done quite well. So we have a registration authority, it's called NADRA, where with CNIC, our national identity card, there are a number of things which have started getting linked into that. Then the central bank, the state bank, has actually done a very good intervention in terms of it's a system, payment system called RAST. But where we are lacking is that this stuff is not integrated. And in the next phase, if you have to move towards e-Pakistan, it's not only these verticals, we have to go horizontal and sort of start linking all these initiatives, which will then help with ease of doing business. It will help, with transparency and everything else. And that's where World Bank Group, not only from funding perspective, but what they have been able to do in other countries and for us to success transfer some of that knowledge into Pakistan as we take it forward, I think is going to be hugely important.
I want to talk about Chinese investment in Pakistan. Of course, in 2015, you had the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor that was launched. By 2022, Chinese investment rose to $65 billion. The Belt and Road Project focuses on things like infrastructure, transport infrastructure, energy projects, these special economic zones. How important has this kind of investment from China been for Pakistan's development?
So I think CPEC, as you know, was the the champion project in terms of Belt and Road. I mean, that was a big commitment from China into Pakistan. And a lot of infrastructure was created during what I call CPEC Phase 1, which was about the road infrastructure, there were ports, and many other things. Now, what was supposed to happen was for us to go into CPEC Phase 2. Now, CPEC Phase 2 was and remains the way we monetize that infrastructure, because that's where these special economic zones come in. But what we need to do is, through the special economic zones, A, bring further Chinese investment, and these are all have to be export-oriented, because once that cycle starts going, a lot of discussion as to how you're going to repay the debt, that's how it was supposed to happen. And as we go forward, I mean, we are very grateful to the Chinese government, we're very grateful to the Chinese banks, that they have been helping us with the on the debt side in terms of rollovers. But ultimately, these debts have to be paid. And that is only going to be there when we get the phase two going in real earnestness. And I can tell you this administration's commitment to that is huge.
Yeah. Lots of challenges, but I want to finish on a positive note. A UN economic survey projects an increase in economic growth from this year to next, with real GDP growth for Pakistan of 2% and 2.3% respectively, it also projects an easing in inflation running at around 26%. They expect that to go down to 12.5% by 2026. So you're confident these can be achieved?
No, from my perspective, normally when we talk about IMF program, the general discussion is it's all about stabilization, forget about growth. But my own view is there are two sectors specifically, agriculture and information technology, which have nothing to do with any external borrowing. It's all levers of growth are in our hands. And if we do the right things in terms of policy framework, policy continuity, increasing local financing to these sectors, I think they are going to be real levers of growth. Just to put it in perspective, the agriculture GDP is growing at 5%. It's the large-scale manufacturing, for the reasons that we have just talked about, is the one which is sort of bringing it down. But agriculture, IT can be big levers of growth. As far as inflation is concerned, our own view is that it's going to come down and that's the purview of the central bank, so therefore I'm quoting them. We saw a peak of 38% last year. It's the March figure is 20.7%. The core inflation is actually 15%. And it's really the Monetary Policy Committee of the central bank, which has said that they are quite comfortable that we'll get to 5 to 6% range by the time we get to September 25. So yeah, it gets into 25, 26 fiscal year. But I think the number is going to be much lesser than what you've just quoted.
In January, Egypt officially joined the BRICS bloc of emerging economies, of which China is a founding member. I spoke with Egyptian Finance Minister Mohamed Maït about the country's economy, efforts to tackle inflation, and its ties with China.
Minister, thanks so much for joining us. The relationship between Egypt and China goes back a long way. You have very strong ties. In fact, Egypt was among the countries that opened diplomatic relations with China when it became the People's Republic of China. It was the first Arab country to do that. It was the first African country to do that. China is also Egypt's premier trading partner. How would you characterize the relationship between the two countries?
I believe it is a strategic relationship, and I believe that, as you've mentioned, China is number one trade partner with Egypt by far. And I believe that a lot of cooperation going on in many sector of the economy. We see Chinese companies building the financial district and the new capital. We see Chinese industrial zone and the Suez Canal economic zone. We see cooperation between the Central Bank of Egypt and the Central Bank of China. We see Ministry of Finance issued the first Banda bond in the China capital market as the first country in the Middle East and Africa to issue Banda bond in Chinese capital market. A lot of cooperation between different entities in Egypt and China, and even at the highest level between the two presidents, relationship with China going at the highest level, at the economic, at the political, different sectors, the cooperation is growing.
Right, and looking at some of the other specifics in the relationship, of course, Egypt and China are in a strategic, comprehensive partnership. In fact, the Egyptian and the Chinese foreign ministers met earlier this year, and during that meeting, they signed the second five-year implementation outline of that partnership. What can we expect from that second five-year part of the plan?
I expect more cooperation. I expect more trade and more support from China. I see that even in the last 2 years when Egypt's economic situation was under huge pressure, a lot of support came from China. through, as I said, the two central banks. China opened the capital market for Egypt. I will see more of such cooperation. I hope that Chinese industrial area and the Suez Canal will grow faster, and they will see more Chinese projects, particularly in industry and telecommunication. So we'll see more cooperation on the political level, on the highest level. I see that many Chinese companies started to open projects in Egypt for production for Egypt and for exports. So this means that more support, more trade, and more also cooperation, even at the issues of mutual interests for both countries. I see the whole world needs such a cooperation to support peace and stability and prosperity in our region and around the world. So such cooperation will benefit the region and the world.
Yeah, you mentioned telecommunications. Of course, that's a very important sector. The Egyptian communications utility Telecoms Egypt signed an agreement with the Chinese tech giant Huawei that was not so long ago, last month. It's a multi-million dollar agreement in which Huawei will roll out 5G networks in Egypt. It's been described as something that will revolutionize the Egyptian telecommunications landscape. Could you give us some idea of what that will do, the impact it will have on Egypt, especially at a time when more and more of the world is moving towards a digital economy?
I believe there is huge hope and the reliance on such cooperation to take Egypt to a stage when, as you've mentioned, 5G and also I believe cooperation on many aspects with Huawei and the Ministry of Telecommunication. And I'm aware of such a cooperation, and I have had the meetings. I have had meetings with Huawei in order to see how can we, address some of the challenges regarding some issues with the Ministry of Finance. And we're going to help on that, because we see that this project will be very important for the future of Egypt. So this will take Egypt to a stage which Egypt needs for the future digitalization. And we are moving very fast on automation, digitalization, and financial inclusions. And such a project will help and support Egypt to achieve its objectives for the 2030 vision on the telecommunication aspect.
Egypt, of course, is now a member of BRICS, the expanded BRICS. It's also a partner in the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And as you pointed out, the Central Bank of Egypt, as well as the Bank of China, are now in a partnership. How significant is this involvement for Egypt in these institutions?
Egypt started with membership of the New Development Bank, which is now Egypt is a member of the 8 countries currently, 5 countries of BRICS, plus Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Bangladesh. Egypt became a full member of BRICS this year. And also, as you've mentioned, the agreement between the two ministers of foreign affairs in both countries who signed this strategic agreement. So all of this will mean that more integration, particularly that with BRICS, I started the meeting in Sao Paulo. It was our first meeting as a member of the BRICS. So I see that more trade and some sort of investment, some sort of facilitating more cooperation on some of the challenges.
That's it for this special edition of The Heat. I'm Arnab Naidu in Washington, D.C.